Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is the 27th of June, 2018. I need to start off with an unfortunate announcement. My website, as some of you know, rushjournal.org, is down. It's been damaged. My webmaster is not entirely sure what happened. They're not ruling out foul play. It's not censorship from the server, but there has been damage to it. It is a private server, and it needs to be reconstructed, and security needs to be beefed up. It's going to be about a week before it's back on air again. But I need to make sure that this doesn't happen again, not just for my own sake and your sake, but for my donors. If you were to go to rushjournal.org now, it will redirect you to a page that my friend Sven Longshanks put together a while ago for the archives of this show. And right up on top, there is a donation button where you can donate to PayPal, which then comes to me. You donate to me through PayPal. And now, because we have this unfortunate emergency, I need some money to take care of this. I thought this would just be a cheap matter. I even thought I could do it myself. It's more serious than that, or so I've been told. This is not my webmaster's fault. This is a private server, but there's been substantial damage. It's not my fault. Foul play hasn't been ruled out, but it is a possibility. Since there have been, if you remember earlier this year, the Warden Post, a journal that I love very much and I write for, an excellent journal, was hacked badly. And it took more than a month to put it back up. And they had to get, Forsenic, web specialists and everything else to find out what happened, to reconstruct everything, and then to make certain that it doesn't happen again. I'm more or less at that stage now. I'm not looking at a month, or I think it was 2 months for him. But it's far worse than I thought. I thought this was just maybe not paying a bill or something like that. No, it's worse than that. And I have to pay people for this. This is a specialized matter. I apologize for being so maudlin about this and so dramatic about this, but I needed this like a hole in the head. But the story, that we have enemies, we have people, whether spiritual or physical, who want to hurt us. We should take that as a matter of pride. It means that we matter. It means that we're hurting people. It means that we've drawn blood. That this little show is not so little. 2 years ago, the Russian embassy ordered a crate of my book on Putin. It was more than that. And I sent it to a guy, Ukrainian guy, the head of media, whatever it's called, over there. I don't know what came of it, but obviously I'm rustling feathers, and we're talking about in an age now where the gloves are off, far worse than ever before, where the election of Trump has meant that the media now has removed any semblance of the act they used to put on that they were objective writers. That's gone. And then on top of that, you have the post-Charlottesville situation. As most of my listeners know, I was there. I was maced and blinded by someone. I have pictures of the guy. There's no pictures of him macing me directly, but there's a picture of me and him, but none of him actually macing me. And this was, as some of you know, a bear mace that adheres to the eye, and it tore my eye, occlusions in two eyes. And it took about 4 days to heal. And some of my brothers in the movement were with me, came to the hospital with me and everything else, and it was really amazing. And then Matt Parrott put together a GoFundMe for my medical bills, which I paid. And I paid them with that money because University of Virginia was very, very good to me. They had an eye doctor who they called in from home. The only hospital in the area that has one on call. He set me up with all these crazy machines that, that cleared out my eye and that showed exactly what was going on and the proper prescription. It took quite a while. They didn't ask any questions. You know, we weren't, you know, they didn't really care. It was just a matter of professionalism in their case. And he told me what the mace was, that it was a specialized bear mace that's not available to everybody. And they were very good to me. And they were very fast and they were very efficient. There was no wait time. So when Matt Parrott set up that GoFundMe, I or GoFundMe back then, I absolutely used every penny of that to pay about 2/3 of my medical bills because I'm not going to stiff them on that with their very professional behavior. So this stuff seems to happen to us all the time. Post-Charlottesville, post-Trump, the regime just doesn't care anymore. They're not following the law, and they don't care. Those of you who know the saga of Jacob Goodwin, who was right by me, I think, know that his defense attorney threw the case. He didn't call a single witness. How many witnesses? We had 1,000 witnesses there. He didn't call a single one. He went in front of the jury and said, yes, my client's a criminal, but yes, he committed assault, but not aggravated assault. Worse to that effect. Absolutely throwing the case. We had video, or I would say he had video, proving his innocence. He had video showing that savage, whatever his name is, acting violent and attacking everyone. All of this, none of this was used in court. The jury, the local jury there, which is mostly female, was going to convict him no matter what. I mean, they didn't want to be seen as soft on Nazis because something would happen to them. And now you've seen the judge in the Brock Turner case has been recalled. In other words, if you don't do what feminists and others say, your career will be destroyed, even if you're a judge. And of course, judges are supposed to be insulated from popular opinion. They're supposed to apply the law and the Constitution and nothing else. He's been now recalled. So we cannot hope, as unfortunately Jacob Goodwin discovered, the jury has requested 10 years. I don't know about Virginia law, but I think the jury can suggest or even impose the sentence, a decade behind bars as a white nationalist in an all-black prison system. That's called cruel and unusual punishment by any standard. In other words, he's going to be in solitary confinement for a decade. This is what we're facing out there. And I'm proud and happy to call him my comrade. I didn't know him personally. But you see, when we go any trial, anything having to do with the system in this environment, they will, and they don't care. They'll throw the law out the window and say, what are you going to do about it? Who's going to come to your defense? They killed Edgar Steele in prison. Out in Idaho, no one cared. No one said a word. Who's going to defend him? And no one came to Goodwin's defense despite the fact that he didn't have a legal defense at all. And this lawyer is an absolute crook. I've seen some of the transcripts. I've seen a lot of the so-called testimony. The defense rested without offering any witnesses whatsoever, even though there were 100 of us there. This is what we're facing. And apparently this has happened now to me yet again. So yet again, I call on my friends and supporters for help. So the rushjournal.org has a redirect. If you know, go to my site, it will redirect you to the site that so then set up that has the donation button. I need to pay these guys. And I'm sorry for this, but that's simply the fact of the matter. But as some of you know, there's nothing that can happen personally that I can't connect to the world around us. you know, I could connect pretty much anything that happens to us to the, on a personal level, to the broader social world, because in fact, they're all connected. And, so that being said, I am going to give a lecture, which I've given many, many years ago. This is a very different version, on Nikolai Berdyaev, the famous Russian existentialist philosopher. I believe it was 2010. There'll be a link on this quite a while ago. I did a lecture on him. And I really haven't been studying him as much since then. But recently, I've stumbled across some of his Russian language things, especially his, the realm of spirit, realm of Caesar, the realm of inequality, the philosophy of inequality, freedom in the spirit, all of these. These are some great works, and his attacks on the bourgeoisie, which was something that he's known for. Existentialism doesn't mean individualism in the sense of egotism. Berdyaev, you know, really doesn't translate well into the West, because the West only really has two functions. That is collectivism or individualism. So an existentialist is automatically thrown into the individualist category, which is identical with egotism. I mean, that's how vulgar it is now. But a Russian existentialist is going to be very, very different from the decadence that developed in the West. The communists like Jean-Paul Sartre. Now, how he could be an existentialist and a communist at the same time is a mystery. But these guys, consistency isn't their great forte, and they know where the fashion is. And Sartre was nothing if not fashionable. Berdyaev was far more honest. He had Gnostic tendencies. There's no question about that. He had Gnostic tendencies. Not nearly as bad. I mean, I think more so even than Soloviev. I think Soloviev is not as Gnostic as he often gets painted, but Berdyaev, was more blatant about it, but only in a few works. The bulk of his material is actually very solid and very useful for it. I'm going to quote him a lot here for the rest of our time. Some of these are in English already. Some of them I've translated. I'm working on a lengthy paper now, and this all really happened just over the last few days. All of a sudden, I just came across this stuff. And in the, whatever it's been, 8-9 years since I did the last lecture on Berdyaev, I've grown quite a bit as a thinker, and now I'm starting to see, you know, you read a work 10 years ago, you read a work now, really you're not reading the same thing, because you're seeing yourself is changed quite a bit. And actually one of the central features of Berdyaev's thinking is that all knowledge is self-knowledge. And what he means by that is that what we think we know from the external world is really a projection. Anyway, he starts off, this is from The Realm of Spirit, in 1949, he says this: "The philosophy of freedom begins with a free act before which there is nothing. Nor can there be existence being. If we were to begin with being as the basis and recognize the primacy of being over freedom, then everything, including freedom, is determined by being. But a determined freedom is not freedom at all." Now, I think that the dichotomy there is a false one, because he's referring to the creation. That God's will, of course, is the very first aspect of existence, because it was his will that brought everything into being. But God at this time was outside of time. So there's no distinction between existence and essence with God anyway. He is the only being where existence and essence are one and the same. What he's arguing is that the primacy of the deed means that his existence precedes his essence, or the phenomenal precedes the noumenal. Now, for us, it's perfectly orthodox, because we have this damaged nature that we inherit. It's intrinsically damaged, and it's conformed to evil, because we're all born and raised in a society dedicated to sin. But if it's applied to God, it's most certainly not orthodox. He says this too in the Freedom in the Spirit, 1928. "Freedom of the spirit, which itself gives birth to consequences, which creates life, is revealed to us as baselessness. A force from the boundless deep. We cannot feel a base, foundation for freedom. Nowhere can we find some solid element which determines freedom from within. Freedom of the spirit is a bottomless well. Our substantial nature could not be the basis of freedom, On the contrary, all nature is born of freedom. This is the exact same concept, 20 years apart on two different topics, but the exact same argument. A free act is a subjective act, but it's never an arbitrary one. Something has to act. Existence has to convert. For Berdyaev, it doesn't exist. God is pure spirit, and thus he is free by definition. But in that case, essence and existence are the same. It doesn't apply to him. But a spirit, any spirit, whether it be the human soul or anything else, is that which acts without a cause, that is, without natural causality. Nature begins in freedom. It is to say that it was God's free act that creates it. The objective order, and this is essential to Berdyaev, is the lowest aspect of creation. The objective, meaning the world of objects. He was dedicated to delegitimizing everything that focused on the objective world. That would include institutions and policies and ideologies and dogma. Not belief or principles, but dogma. He says, and this is why so much of his, what he does say is orthodox. Every freedom always predicates discipline and asceticism and always perishes if these things are lacking. In other words, freedom is never arbitrary. It has to proceed from the spirit. Reason is spirit in the sense that it's not caused by natural means. Berdyaev says freedom demands that man maintain his dignity and purity, that he control himself. In other words, the ascetic life is about being free. Berdyaev is a philosopher of freedom in the older philosophical sense. The modern conception of freedom is this arbitrary act born out of passion or impulse. Reason or spirit need not be the origin or the end of the act. In fact, our society is ruled by consumer impulse. Therefore, reason is bad for business. And so he is the modernists always have tried to use him, try to manipulate him for their own ends, but he says this, and this is something that angers liberals all the time. He despised liberalism. And he says, freedom is aristocratic, not democratic. With sorrow, we must recognize the fact that freedom is dear only to those men who can think creatively. It is not very necessary to those who don't value thinking. In democracies, so-called, based on the principle of popular sovereignty, a considerable portion of people are those who have not yet become conscious of themselves as free beings, bearing within themselves a dignity of freedom. Education to freedom is something still ahead of us, and this will not be achieved anytime soon. One of the biggest pet peeves I've ever experienced is a constant reference to all and every. Christ died for everybody. He died for all men, all humanity. Those conceptions didn't exist in the ancient world. Only in the modern, even postmodern world, do you have the use of the word every or all to refer to every single member of the class. So the lecture I did on women, I get the stupid response that, well, they're not all like that. I said, no kidding. That's a stupid statement. Do you really believe that I polled every single female on the planet? That's a stupid, lazy thing to say to me. That's implied. I'm referring to a class. I'm not referring to every member of that class. They're two different things. One thing you want to watch out for when you're arguing with leftists, and they're getting more and more irrational as time goes on, is that they don't know how to keep their levels of analysis apart. You talk about race, they refer to individuals. In other words, thinking that Black America is a negative on American society, which of course it is, means that you hate Black people. And it's so infantile. And so, no, those are two different things. They're individuals that make up a class. And then there's the class. The class is a social force that functions despite many of its individuals. I'm not making reference to the individuals. My neighbor is a good guy. That's not the problem. As a class, though, and they don't know how to tell that apart. And really, it's a form of manipulation. And the nominalist bias and the vulgarization of thought, we're at a point now where people really can't keep those apart. So the way that Berdyaev defined freedom, it has no basis. He says, you know, it has to come from rationality, without self-interest or any heteronomous source. And it's very, very difficult. I've said for 25 years that freedom is for the few, just like Berdyaev says. It's rare. To be a man, to be a human being, you have to be free and rational. You have to be self-controlled. You have to be independent. You have to be autonomous. The moment abstractions like everyone begin, start being used as demagogic slogans, freedom as an idea is debased beyond recognition. It was absorbed into the market, the cash nexus, so it's stripped of all rational content. And he says in The Destiny of Man, written in 1931, he says, so-called public opinion is based on conventional lie and employs falsehood as a means of influence. Every social mode is a conventional lie. Falsehood is recognized as useful to support and organize human society and fulfill the social function. Herein is the tragedy of the problem of falsehood. Pragmatically, falsehood justifies itself, while truth and right often appear dangerous and hurtful. I translated that myself, but there is a concept of the noble lie here. Lies can be useful in society. There's many things that the common run of people couldn't understand. It's simply too complex. And so oversimplifying it to the point of non-recognition may be absolutely necessary, especially where there's prejudice involved. They're necessary in a limited sense because rationality is rare. They don't think as individuals. People don't think, they think as members of a group, and they're easily led astray. Now, of course, the problem here is that, you know, conventional lies, exist everywhere. I mean, policy, you know, Berdyaev doesn't like politics because policy, is based on lies. It has to oversimplify everything. It has to treat everyone as atoms, not as people, but as individuals. I mean, everyone tells a lie. Everyone tells a story about themselves, how we got to where we are. No one's innocent of that. These are myths rather than lies. It's an oversimplification of a complex truth. He says, an innocent lie can be a condition for the possibility of human community. So, for example, someone is polite with another who he hates in public. In other words, this kind of lie is necessary for social life. Can you imagine if you lived like me, just spouted whatever you thought of someone right without any filter? You know, people on the outliers of society, it's okay, but if everyone did that, it would be absolutely disastrous. However, this is not the lying he's talking about. Truth and falsehood is essential to him. But lying is at the root of the modern state, because the collectivist drive is based on destroying the conscience. It's the lifeblood of really not just organized states, but organized anything. So he says, personality is a subject and not an object among other objects. It has its roots in the inward scheme of existence in the spiritual world. Society, on the other hand, is an object. From the existential point of view, society is a part of personality, its social side. Just as the cosmos is a part of personality, its cosmic side. Personality is not an object among other objects and not a thing among other things. It is a subject among subjects, and the turning of it into an object or a thing means death. The very stark confrontation that Berdyaev gives to everybody, and every existentialist is like this, and it's one thing they have in common, is you either live freely and rationally, which is extremely difficult, or you become das Mann, as Heidegger would say, or live in bad faith, like Kierkegaard and Sartre would say. Das Mann and bad faith means that you hide. You hide behind something. Bad faith is something that lies at the root of everything modern. I mean, he's aware when he's talking about freedom as an aristocratic possession. He knows that the average man is and always will be a mindless drone. Now, in a healthy society, that's, you know, those people serve their functions doing whatever they do. You know, Burke's conception of prejudice, one of the first ideas in political theory I ever came across. Is that you can't think every moral question as you're doing it. That would be impossible. Prejudice is just you react from your gut, so to speak. Heidegger even makes reference to this. But in an unhealthy society, to be a mindless drone is to willingly go along with evil. Freedom is scary. Living, because you wouldn't have to live the life that we do. To be free, to be an actual human being, which is free and rational, otherwise it's not human, means that your reason has to begin penetrating appearance to unveil the essence. No one wants to do that. No one wants to see what's behind the curtain. Their life would be destroyed. Dependency is sought at all costs. He's referring to an aristocracy of the spirit. To believe that everyone is capable of this metaphysical transcendence is laughable. The masses have no idea how to even define the terms, and they care even less. And we can be thankful for that. Everyone says, I wish these people who go crazy at baseball games and football games will put that energy to politics. I say, don't you dare say that. Not everybody's a political person. That's all we need, is all this kind of misguided mob. No, political science is a highly specialized field. It's not for everybody. It's okay to be into football and baseball. That doesn't make them stupid. People start talking like that, you need to stop them. No, they should not be involved. This kind of life is no fun. This kind of life is being exposed to the worst of humanity 24 hours a day and, having all your predictions come true and have no one listen to you. This is not a happy life. So we're talking about mass man here. We're talking about, living in what Berdyaev would call the objective world, seeking solace and protection in institutions and structures. By himself, man is absolutely nothing. By grace and God's action, man can be more than just some logical calculating machine. Bad faith hides behind institutions, policy. When someone says, oh, it's company policy, it's out of my hands. This is bad faith. They don't have to worry about it. They could just throw something out there. No, it's not my fault. It's out of my hands. It's not my problem. Find someone else to concern themselves with. This kind of dishonesty, Berdyaev says, reaches its zenith in the bourgeoisie. They are the most destructive and decadent group that's ever walked the earth. They are the synthesis of all the evil that has come before. 1926, he says this. What are the spiritual roots of the bourgeoisie? It's an excessive belief in this visible world and unbelief in the other invisible world. The bourgeois mind is struck by the visible world of things, shocked by it, seduced by it. He doesn't take any other reality seriously. He rejects all spiritual things and demands that all others, and believes all others, I should say, should be like himself. The bourgeois man always says to himself, we know you. You're all like me, but you don't want to admit it. You're just deceiving yourself. All of you live by the blessings of this world and accept nothing but external reality. For this reason, the bourgeois puts himself above others because he recognizes this and admits it. The bourgeois is not a symbolist, since the symbolic world is totally alien to him. Now, what he's saying, of course, and you've heard this a million times, the argument that, everyone's out for money. Everyone's out for power. When you talk about sexual morality, they'll say, teenagers have always had sex, like they do now. No, 80 years ago and beyond, it was almost impossible for a boy and a girl to be alone together. That was extremely rare. It simply wasn't done. No, they didn't have sex like they do now, not even close. And any man or boy who tried to push that would probably be run out of town, at best. It's assumed that historical actors, especially if they're working in the church, are driven solely by material and carnal drives. Well, you don't know that. Professors do this all the time. The only people who they exempt from that is themselves. In other words, they say, because we live this way, we live in this lower world, the rest of you are hypocrites, because you really don't believe in this upper world, and you act just like us. The word hypocrite, as I've said many times before, is very overused. Hypocrite means not that you're inconsistent. That's inconsistent. Everyone's inconsistent. Hypocrisy means that you simply don't believe the realm of ideas that you're making reference to. Everyone's inconsistent. It's so easy for people with no standards to condemn people who have high ones. And you don't even need to be a capitalist to fall into these categories that Berdyaev is talking about. But you hear it all the time. You're all just like us. But what they all have in common in every era is mediocrity. Now, it's a strange thing about the Russian language, and this hasn't been addressed yet. Even in English translations of Berdyaev and others, the word creativity is substituted for what we would call meaningful work. And what they don't seem to realize is that in English, creativity is usually an artistic thing. Think of creativity, you think of an artist, you think of a poet. So when a Russian philosopher is referring to meaningful, directed, skillful labor, they use creativity because the word is one and the same. Trud is usually referred to as labor, but it's the same word as creativity. To be creative is to do something other than drudgery. This isn't just stuff you have to do. It is the attempt to overcome the objective world by mixing the objective with your freedom. So it's a different take on John Locke. I mean, value comes from the human being mixing this nothing or this matter that exists outside of him with his reason and skill. He creates an object, therefore that object becomes his. Now, of course, if that were true, capitalism would collapse immediately because very few people get the products of their labor. But that's the foundation for private property in John Locke. That's the origin of mixing up the different senses of the word property. When Karl Marx used property, he didn't mean private property. I mean, he meant capital. He didn't mean your toothbrush or your automobile. And that's been deliberately manipulated over time. So property has different meanings, but I've never come across a translation of Berdyaev that didn't use creativity and without an explanation. I think a lot of people think they're talking about nothing but artwork. But he changes Locke's idea, and it's not so much that there's this nothing that we impose our will upon. We overcome the objective. We overcome the external brute world by mixing that brute world with our own freedom. And this is what creativity is. This is what labor is. And this is what the bourgeoisie has never understood. They assume that everyone wants to get a job and offers them the most money. And if that's not the case, then there's something wrong with them. When I was in college and told people this is what I wanted to do, the first thing that they would say often was, well, what are you going to do with that? In other words, if you can't immediately translate it into a paycheck and benefits, it's not worth pursuing. And the answer I always gave was, what are we going to do without it? Academic liberal arts are stagnating in liberal, absolutely mindless conformity and fear. There's no serious research being done in academia in these subjects right now. Not in history, not in philosophy, certainly. Philosophy is nothing but word games now. These departments have to be shut down. It was, and UNLV actually shut down its philosophy department. I throw a little party for that. I mean, they just play word games. They don't do philosophy anymore. I actually had a professor at Nebraska say in the philosophy department that what we do is we clarify, the purpose of philosophy is to clarify research questions for science. Actually, I heard that from more than one professor. This is an analytic thing. And I said, first of all, you've just destroyed the basis of your own discipline. And second of all, science doesn't need you. I've never heard of a scientist calling up a philosopher saying, I don't know how to formulate this question. But I've heard this from more than one professor. These are idiots. But this is a result. This is a mentality that comes from the bourgeois mentality. Now, one of Berdyaev's great works, and one that, needless to say, isn't read a whole lot in English, is The Philosophy of Inequality. Berdyaev absolutely holds equality and contempt. Because equality is something that has to be forcibly imposed on things. Equality comes from institutions and policies and coercion. And here's how he talks about it. He says this. This is kind of hard to translate, but let me do it roughly here. The world of Dionysius is democratic. The world of Apollo is aristocratic. Dionysianism rests on a spontaneous popular basis. The unlimited triumph of democracy comes a Dionysian orgy that sweeps away the personality and plunges the spirit of man into chaos. Dionysianism is hostile to every hierarchy. Dionysianism triumphs in the epoch of revolution and mass popular movement. This triumph always jeopardizes the greatest spiritual values and surrenders the greatest spiritual realities. The origin is aristocratic. The beginning of the hierarchical mode of life, of form and limit, establishing difference, saves the higher spiritual life, protects the sources of light, and protects man from being torn to pieces. The existence of personality presupposes differences and distances, one from another, forms and boundaries. Revolutionary Dionysianism destroys all differences, all forms and boundaries, and therefore it is deeply hostile to the individual and does not recognize his personhood. Berdyaev hates the notion of mixing classes and different classes of person. The lowest form of plebeianism, destroying the boundaries from one class, one group, or one person to another. His idea of personalism is qualitative and only qualitative. It is never quantitative. The world of quantity to him is to have scorn heaped upon it. Now, theologically, we find this in Chalcedon. As I've said a billion times, the Synod of Chalcedon was the single greatest historical event in Western history. The West would be unrecognizable without it. And what it does, among other things, is that it shows how a person can face the divine without surrendering his independence. Now, you still have professors of theology talking about Chalcedon and the Monophysites. They're just talking, quibbling over details. They're so vulgar, they don't understand how the entire Western philosophy of the person, at its best, comes from Chalcedon. And what a disaster it would have been for one of the heretical sides to have won that. But that's the model that we have. That you have the human being and God, you know, the person, you know, again, the person is not the ego, functioning together independently, with the person being able to fall away at any time. Chalcedon is the model. And he says that the social scientists in academia in his day, he says they're all in the power of the Dionysian element, tormented by demons of chaos, and he says to them, you don't know the person and you don't know freedom. Revolutions bring about the total state and the reduction of the person to an ego. This is a primordial darkness. The person becomes part of the mass by force, and what makes man man is destroyed. The spiritual principle is aristocratic, not democratic, as he says. Democratic thinking is darkness. Now, the aristocratic thinking, this is a result of struggle between the person and the individual, between the person and institutions and ideologies. When I say ideology, I don't mean principles or beliefs, I mean ideologies. It comes from the spirit forcing itself away from the static earth. He talks about the instant triumph of revolution. It makes no distinctions and calls the population a mass. The left always refer to the population as the masses because they have no identity. Everything is standardized and the person is lost. But even when he's talking about freedom, which is the central concept, in the postmodern West, and even in his own day, it's used without a referent. It's used without reference to ends or the subject. It's simply a word. Freedom for the masses is merely an enslavement to passion. That's how it's defined today. Freedom is to do whatever you want, so long as you don't harm anybody else, and that harm is never defined properly, or defined at all. So if this enslavement to passion is unchecked, reason will eventually be defaced entirely. So what's freedom? Well, to be a human being is to be free and rational. But to be free is the opposite of being enslaved to your passions and drives. So freedom is the liberation from chaos and freedom from the passion. He says, that is why all deep-seated people understood, all deep-thinking people, I should say, true aristocrats, in other words, understood that true liberation involves a moment of penance, self-discipline, and self-restraint. Without the ascetic life, freedom is impossible. You know, the social conception of the virtue of humility is precisely that. Not everything I want should be imposed on others. Not everything's a lawsuit. Not everything is a matter of, you know, you call the police because someone is bothering you, which happens all the time. Someone's irritating to you. This is what happens when freedom is defined in its Dionysian way. When the will is spontaneously unchained or unchecked, it becomes a slave to its desires. The man becomes completely exhausted by his own sin. And he says, he spits at the revolutionaries. He says, you, the liberators of man, you unchain the elements, have long considered the problem of the individual. Why are there no personalities in your revolution? Why is it given to the destruction of what seems to be natural storms? Why do we see the image of the person drowning in the elements about which you sing praises? And a lot of my thinking on nominalism comes from Berdyaev, and no one really took him up on this. The revolution, you know, he's referring to revolutionaries on the left, all factions, including libertarians. Because I don't know, you know, libertarians, you know, the worst of the libertarians just define freedom as, you know, hedonism. I'm not sure without asceticism how you can avoid that. No revolution has ever harmonized man with the society or the state. And he says, I mean, and using terms that sound very modern, he says to these people, he said, you're out of touch with reality. For you, neither the person nor the society is real. And one of the most important things he's ever said, what I think is one of the most powerful condemnations of revolutionary ideology I've ever read, in the Philosophy of Inequality, he says this. Your revolutionary worldview is just extreme nominalism. In social philosophy, it's just atomism. Your collectivism is just the opposite sign of this nominalism. You have lost actual realities and want to place a new, artificial, illusory reality in their place. Your worldview denies any ontological realism. Your ancestors are sophists. You rejected the foundations of ontological social philosophy laid down by Plato. Plato's too aristocratic for you, and you saw in him the source of the word reaction. Plato's socialism was aristocratic socialism, based on the recognition of the hierarchy of ontological reality. Plato recognized the ontological reality of the whole, the reality of the supreme good and truth, but you proceed from the atomization of every whole. You begin with a rejection of the supreme good and the highest truth. Your truth is arbitrary, subjective, it's class truth. It's born out of self-interest and passion. You start your revolution only after all that is real, all that is integral, all actual community are destroyed. Then you want to build your new utopia on nothing. I say that that's, you know, in Russian or any other language, that's one of the best condemnations. Revolution, liberalism, Marxism, whatever it is, in one paragraph. Unpacking this it takes a very long time to do. I've said I have a book coming out on the Soviet Union, and one of the arguments I make in there, actually, one of the theses of the book is that, you know, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union didn't give a damn about workers. That wasn't on the agenda. That was a code word for something else. You could be a proletarian billionaire. Trotsky referred to Schiff as a proletarian, member of the working class. But a poverty-stricken priest is a capitalist. Something like that, you know, or a right-winger in Russia, member of the URP or something like that was a capitalist, even if he was poverty stricken. Trotsky says this, Lenin says it. And so when the Soviets talk about labor and everything else, socialism, you know, they're not referring to actual workers. They never have. You see, when the Soviets finally took over, when the Reds took over at the end of the Civil War, they actually found real socialist functioning institutions that were popular and egalitarian, like the peasant commune, the urban artel, which is a workers' union, informal workers' union, the Orthodox Brotherhood of the Holy Cross, which I've done a whole lecture on, Napuviev's movement. They actually found many worker collectives and cooperatives throughout the country, church-sponsored and otherwise. They actually inherited a country with a tremendous and deep history of socialism in the best sense of the word, especially at the local level. And the first thing they did is destroy every last one of them. That alone, that by itself is sufficient to destroy any claim that they cared about labor. I mean, pages and pages of analysis about labor and capital, and they did nothing and didn't want to do anything for actual functioning workers. And the worker in the Soviet Union was mercilessly exploited. But his argument in this one paragraph, it contains everything that people like us have been condemning in the left for decades. They condemn actual functioning community. You know, they condemn the family. They condemn the nation. You know, they condemn the congregation. They hate all this stuff. You know, all of these reactionary institutions. But once they destroy all of this, what do they have to work with? The personality is a creation of the commune. The ego is a creation of chaos. So, you know, Berdyaev said, he says, with no foundation for any community, because you've destroyed it all, you have no choice but to herd people into collectives, held together by force. It's the left's most fundamental contradiction that makes them universally absurd. They demand community at the same time destroying anything that could actually create a community, including functional ancient communities in their own society. They destroy all of this. The collective farms had nothing in common with the peasant commune, as most of you probably know. And the collective farm was this random people, vaguely in the same neighborhood, those that survived. And these Jewish party commissars didn't know the first thing about farming. And they threw them all together and said, okay, you're going to have to produce now. And the West was feeding the Soviets. So peasants could be killed in large numbers. The West was pouring food aid into the country after the Reds won. But the collective is not the community. In a society that's been destroyed, any foundation for community has been destroyed, all you have is the ego, the rule of force, the will to power. Creating a community then has to be done by force and therefore becomes nothing but a collective. That's what he's trying to say here. Once you've destroyed the identity of a people and who they are, you can't expect any community. Continuing his attack on the revolutionary, some of you know that in the Brothers Karamazov, Ivan is condemning God because of the unrequited suffering of a child, innocent suffering, in other words. And that somehow denies the all-powerful and all-good God. But Berdyaev says this to the left, communists and otherwise. The atheist does not care about the tears of a child and all the sufferings of life. He rebels against God in the name of a happy and blessed human destiny on earth. But he's now ready to shed innumerable tears and inflict innumerable sufferings so that the human life will be happy and painless as soon as possible. This is the moral contradiction of all revolutionaries. You, the Russian revolutionary intellectual, have always talked a lot about the child's tears, unbearable suffering of the innocent. It was your favorite topic. You fell into a false sentimentality and then promised a painless paradise. But when the hour of your rule came, you created unprecedented cruelty. You've turned your country into a sea of tears and caused it untold misery. Sentimentality often ends in cruelty. In other words, to create paradise, they have to create hell first. And this is a problem not just in revolutionary societies, but politics in general. Any policy, especially in a large country, sees people as just a faceless mass. When you remove personality, you're left with abstractions. Atoms. And all atoms look the same. Politics in large states, modern politics, is about standardization, about quantity, not people. The abstract man, as a subject of policy, has no history, has no connection with his ancestors. He isn't anything. He's a blip on a computer screen. The abstractions of the academic social scientist, these are purely invention. It's the alienation of the urban intellectual projected onto the world. These are the same people, by the way, who condemn us because the nation is imaginary. The masses, as masses, they have nothing in common one with another. It's like claiming that people staying in the same hotel are a society. Some are innocent, some are not. Some are great sinners, some are great benefactors. No policy could fit them all. And Berdyaev makes the argument, he says, that for the left, those who want to impose these laws on people, you don't know the people who it's affecting. You have no idea, given how different their circumstances are, how the law is going to affect people individually. And he says to them, he says, the first thing you have to do is change the world around you in your daily life. Now, I've known enough leftist professors and activists to know that they never do that. Their personal charity is actually very, very rare. It's almost totally absent. I tell the story of David Forsyth, who was the chairman of the department when I was at Nebraska getting my PhD. And he is the dean of human rights studies, United Nations, globalism. This is his focus. And he talks about the freedom of speech and against state-owned presses and everything else. And the U.S. has to impose it, on and on and on. Typical UN kind of crap. When my funding came up in a faculty meeting, he actually called a secret faculty meeting because he didn't like me. He said I was an ideologue and therefore my funding should be cut. In a secret meeting, there was a grad student representative who was sent out of the room. So the dean of human rights studies called a secret meeting, kicked the student representative out of the room, and then secretly denounced me and tried to get me essentially thrown out. But this isn't uncommon. I've known many professors who are like this. They treat people with utter disdain and contempt. But they seek unlimited power to bring joy to the masses. So Berdyaev says, if you actually help people around you personally, including yourself, maybe then you may have a little bit of authority. But helping those around you, working for others, donating your time, that has nothing in common with what he says, the rationalistic weighing of human destinies, the rationalistic comparison of these fates, of their fates and compulsory equation. He heaps scorn on the concept. He says, this is his, utterly, and this is uncharacteristic of him because he's very, very measured. But he kind of loses it here, talking to people who believe in equality. He says this. He says, inequality is the basis of cosmic harmony, the justification, the very existence of the human personality, and the source of all creative movement in the world. Every birth of light in the darkness is the onset of inequality. Every creative movement is the emergence of inequality. It is the elevation, the isolation of quantities from the qualities from the quantitative mass. From inequality, the world and the cosmos were born. From inequality, man was created. Absolute equality would leave the being in an undifferentiated state, total non-being. The requirement of absolute equality is a demand for a return to the initial chaotic and dark state of the cosmos, leveled and undifferentiated. This is a requirement of non-being. The revolutionary demand for a return to equality and non-existence was born out of the reluctance to bear the sacrifice and suffering through which the path of the higher life must go. This is the most terrible reaction, denial of the meaning of the entire creative world process. Again, these are two potent condemnations of the revolutionary ideology. Any cultural marker that any of these people want to point to is a result of one person being better than another. The great works of art, the great works of literature exist because of genius. Because of some, we talked about in the Passionary, in Gumilev, this weird mutation that someone, for no clear reason, puts the needs of the society ahead of his own desire for survival. And without these people, you can't have anything. You still be living in caves. All of this comes from inequality. Anything. I mean, he's saying any creative endeavor is a result of inequality, of rising above. Equality for Berdyaev really has nothing to do with, you know, everyone getting along. And then equality for him is bureaucracy. It's everyone following the same path, the same policies, watching every word they say, having a script for every aspect of their life, essentially being drones, worker bees. Well, of course, the tiny elites that benefit from that. That's what equality is to him. And that's really what equality is in reality. Equality and sameness are one and the same. They're identical. When someone breaks out of that, he says, every creative movement is the emergence of inequality and elevation, the isolation of qualities from the quantitative mass. It took me a while to translate that. What he means there is that when you're a part of an undifferentiated whole, everyone kind of doing what everyone else is doing, and you break out of that, you discover something, or you have an idea or something like that, you know you're going to get in trouble for it. You know people are going to give you a crap for it. That is inequality. Any great idea is the emergence of inequality. Anything worth anything is inequality. That's where it comes from. That's what it represents. Because equality would mean that any genius, any flowering of inspiration would be smashed as threatening. And we know people like this. We know institutions like this. You know, the masked man, the bourgeoisie, they only see individual things. They only see properties, quantitative things. They devote desire, repulsion. He can see no essences in things. He can't see nations. He can't see personalities. And Berdyaev is one of the few people I know of who writes about nominalism, the belief that no universal truths exist in the world, none exist in man. Everything is just a word. Goodness and truth, they're just words that we come up with. They have no real reference. The universal things are mere words arrived at purely for utilitarian purposes. But nothing can typify the bourgeoisie more than that. That's your typical American middle class idea. Aristocracy comes from suffering. The middle class of the bourgeoisie believe that pain and death are the worst conceivable things out there. We know that that's not true. We know that nothing happens without suffering. Knowledge sees the essence beyond mere appearances. Seeing the essence beyond appearances can get you killed in this society. No truth can come from anything that's based on nominalism. He says to these people, with your sociological abstractions, you've disintegrated reality, taking it from the hierarchy of the cosmic whole and reduced it to the most simple elements discovered by other sciences preceding your sociology. You're simplifiers. Reality escapes from you. You have nothing but abstract pieces of reality, fragments. He says, you've long been committing a pogrom against being as a concrete whole and as a hierarchical object. This rational and frenzied pogrom you commit both in your science and in your politics. You like to moralize over historical reality. You transfer your limited individual moral judgments to the superpersonal and historical life. You're angry about the past and you see only violence and oppression. But you don't understand that that violence has its place, its own truth. It was God's providence breaking through the darkness. Negative things in history, this kind of violence, this is about the emergence of the aristocratic spirit. The aristocratic spirit, Apollo, what Berdyaev says, is actually the human being, the man. Actual freedom comes from being oppressed, comes from being put in a position where you have to use creativity to work your way out of it. That's where greatness comes from. And that's absolutely essential to Berdyaev's philosophy. And with all the studies in English that have been done on him, that's one aspect of it that's not talked about, and we all know why. Because there's nothing that threatens this sick society more than intellectual aristocracy. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.